The Tom Woods Show, episode 2166.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I want to run you through something that I think you'll find valuable. This is an article that Michael Malice recommended to me that's from 2004. And he recommended it a number of years ago when he was on the Tom Woods Show. He mentioned it in passing, and then I forgot about it. And then recently, it came to mind, and I read it myself, and I thought, okay, I see why Michael likes this. I see why he would say this was influential in his own thinking. I see a bit of Malice throughout this thing. And it's a piece called What You Can't Say by a guy named Paul Graham. And if you go to his bio, the first sentence of his bio is simply, Paul Graham is a programmer, writer, and investor. So he's not somebody you're going to run into at a libertarian conference, and you probably never heard of him before. I certainly haven't. But I printed this thing out, marked it up, and I thought it was at least worth talking about because we do obviously live in a time in which there are things you can't say, and a lot of them are really harmless, and yet you can't say them, and yet you could say them 10 years ago. In fact, you could still say them when Paul Graham wrote this article. He was more prophetic than he realized when he wrote it. So he starts off by saying, I'm curious about these kinds of questions. You know, any time in history in which you might live, there was something you couldn't say. That's just been true forever. So let's try to figure out what is it that you can't say in our society. And as he begins this exploration, he starts off with something he calls the conformist test. And he says, let's start with a test. Do you have any opinions that you would be reluctant to express in front of a group of your peers? And this question reminds me of something that Robert George at Princeton University once asked. And I've shared this with you before. Robert George will ask his students, if you lived in 1850 in the United States, would you have been an abolitionist? And he says, the answer from everybody is always, yes, absolutely, I would. Yes, absolutely, I would have been resolutely against slavery. I would have been an activist against it, and I would have been speaking out against it. He said, okay, well, how about that? Imagine the coincidence. Imagine what an amazing coincidence that I have all these abolitionists in my class when at the time, almost nobody in American society was an abolitionist. And the Liberty Party, which was formed in an attempt to get some political momentum behind the ending of slavery, not the free soil people who simply wanted to keep slavery out of the territories, but actually wanted to abolish slavery where it existed at the time, that Liberty Party never got more than 1 or 2% of the vote. And yet, amazingly, my class is 100% abolitionist. How about that? I mean, can you imagine? What are the odds, you know, that all these people would be in my class at the same time? So, of course, his point, and I don't think he was ever quite that snarky about it. I inserted that bit of snark. But his point was, it's pretty unlikely that you would have been, because probably you would have just believed what everybody believed at the time, because today you believe what everybody believes. And he says, tell me how many times you have believed something that you've been vocal about, even though you knew it would damage you. You knew you would be hurt by it in some way. And he says, I have a feeling that for most of you, the answer is zero times. So you're telling me that people who zero times in their lives have believed something and promoted something so controversial that it would harm their social status, their income, their friendships, whatever, people who have done this zero times would have held the most controversial possible position, or at least one of the top handful of controversial possible positions in the United States in 1850. Sorry, I don't believe it. I just don't believe that. And I thought that was a really valuable thought experiment. I happen to think, you might say this is uncharitable. All right, well, so be it. If this is the most uncharitable thing I believe, then I'm doing pretty well. I sometimes think about that wing of the libertarian movement that is so eager to assure the New York Times that although they don't believe in price controls and they have a lot of really, really controversial positions like that, they are not like those really bad libertarians over there. I mean, we're not like Woods or anything. Like, just, we want you to understand, Mr. New York Times person, sir, that we are respectable libertarians and we don't talk about things like secession. Or, I mean, we all know you've told us that's not respectable and that's associated with a discredited cause. So, of course, we know we're not allowed to talk about that. We're just going to stay talking about things that really aren't going to change anything and that are, we're allowed to say, we'll stick to those. We're not like that guy over there. Anybody who talks like that would never have been an abolitionist. Impossible. Impossible for the same reasons that Robert George was talking about. Remember, a lot of these people were the same ones who couldn't even be good on masks. The best they could come up with was, well, they probably shouldn't be mandated, but hey, let's all be responsible during a pandemic. That was as cheeky as they got. Come on. If you couldn't see through that ridiculous charade and you basically adopted the New York Times line on it at a time when we needed sensible voices more than ever, then I'm sorry, I don't trust you on anything. I think you're just a coward and you're pathetic. You know, if you're the type of personality who assures everybody that you are within the respectable bounds of opinion, how could you have been an abolitionist? You know? That's the funny thing, that the very people, like, for example, our friend Walter Block, a professor at Loyola University, New Orleans, some of my newer listeners won't know about the controversies he's been involved in. But for heaven's sake, there were people on his campus who tried to accuse him of believing in slavery. Now, Walter Block is the most radical libertarian any of these people will ever meet. Maybe anybody listening to this podcast will ever meet. Walter Block couldn't possibly be more against all forms of slavery. Every possible use of coercion, Walter is resolutely against. And you know what else about Walter? He's absolutely fearless. He will hold any unpopular position at all if it's where he thinks libertarian principles lead him. He does not care. I don't care how unfashionable it is. If that's where libertarian principles take me, then that's where I go. He's a principled guy. He would have been an abolitionist. Absolutely no doubt in my mind. No doubt whatsoever. And the funny thing is, the people attacking him, it's very hard to believe. Would they really have been in that 1% or 2%? Really? People who are desperate to attack a heretic and assure the world how much different from him they are? Pretty doubtful. Anyway, let's go back to Paul Graham in particular. So he starts off with this test, as I mentioned. Do you have any opinions you would be reluctant to express in front of a group of your peers? And he says, now, if the answer is no, you might want to think about that. I mean, if everything you believe is something you're supposed to believe, could that really be a coincidence? Odds are it isn't. Odds are you just think what you're told. Now, in the course of my talking here, I'm going to quote passages from this article. And as I say, I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/2166. You can also go directly to paulgraham.com/say, S-A-Y. If you don't remember that, just remember this is episode 2166. Or, you know, tomspodcast.com has a list of all the episodes, and you can just find this one and I'll have it linked. So then he says, now, there's another possibility. It's not just the possibility that you just think everything people tell you to think. The other possibility is that you independently considered every question and just happened to come up with exactly the same answers that are now considered acceptable. Okay? I mean, you can evaluate the likelihood of that. And that millions and millions and millions of people evaluated all these widely divergent issues, extremely varied issues, and somehow came up with exactly the same opinion about every one of them that everybody else holds. Maybe. Does that seem likely? And then he says kind of something along the lines of what Professor George said. If you believe everything you're supposed to now, then how can you be sure you wouldn't have believed everything you were supposed to believe in the 1850s in the South in the United States or in 1930s Germany or whatever? Views that now we universally consider repellent, I bet you would have believed those at the time if you believe everything you're supposed to believe today. I mean, at least there's a presumption in favor of the idea that you would have believed those things. Or at the very least, you ought to be asking yourself the question, would I have believed those things? Would I have actually had the strength of character to resist them? Then he says, how do we find out what we can't say? What are the sources? Where do we look? He says, one way to find these things is simply to look at those things that people do say and get in trouble for. That's obvious enough. He says, now, we're not just looking for things we can't say. We're looking for things we can't say that are true or at least have enough chance of being true that the question should remain open. So, yeah, there's a sense in which you probably shouldn't say 2 + 2 = 5 because it's a dumb thing to say. And, you know, maybe you're misleading young children or something, but no one's going to put you in jail for that, or nobody's going to shun you or expel you from society, make you a pariah for that. So it's not that. It's things that have the likelihood that at least there's a remote chance other people could be led to believe them. Let's put it that way. Then secondly, he says, it's possible, though, that there are some forbidden ideas that people just don't ever utter because they're so forbidden. And so then we can't use our test of what do people get in trouble for saying if nobody ever says them in the first place. So he says, what if some idea would be so radioactively controversial that no one would dare express it in public? How can we also find those? And here he says, let's look for labels. He says, in every period of history, there seem to have been labels that got applied to statements to shoot them down before anyone had a chance to ask if they were true or not. So he says, another way to figure out which of our taboos future generations will laugh at is to start with the labels. So he says, take a label, sexist, for example, and try to think of some ideas that would be called that. Then for each, ask, might this be true? Now, that's a completely forbidden thing to say. Even to ask, might this be true, that itself is forbidden. But think about this for a minute. I would say one of the central contentions of people who would be described as woke is that if there are statistical disparities between groups, let's say in educational attainment or income or professional status or whatever, that this is prima facie evidence of discrimination and systemic racism. Or it doesn't have to be racism, it could also be sexism. That is a demonstrably false statement. So it turns out that the anti-woke people who make the forbidden claim that these things are actually not evidence of discrimination, that view is correct. Thomas Sowell spent much of his career explaining why these disparities are not evidence of discrimination. And unlike the woke people who just look at the numbers and say, oh, well, must be racism, his argument is rather sophisticated. He goes in and disaggregates the numbers. And I've talked about this a little bit in the past on the show and elsewhere. In fact, I talked to Walter Williams about it, the late, great Walter Williams, in episode 1038 of the Tom Woods Show. So you can always find these, tomwoods.com/episode number. So tomwoods.com/1038, because he had a book called Race and Economics, How Much Can Be Blamed on Discrimination? And he came up with the answer, not much. I also covered this on my own in episode 508 of the Tom Woods Show. So if you want some detail on that, you can look there. Also, Thomas Sowell's book, Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality, covers this thoroughly. You cannot put that book down and still believe the woke worldview. You just can't do it. He had a more recent book, which I need to take a look at because I haven't read this one, but I've read the Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality one. But he has one called Discrimination and Disparities, which I'm sure is a more up-to-date version of the argument. So I'll link to these at tomwoods.com/2166 if you'd like to take a look at them. All right, let me take a minute in the middle of all this to thank our sponsor for this episode, BetterHelp. If you had to own the same car for your entire life, I promise you would take really good care of it. Well, you own the same brain for your whole life, and your brain also needs to be cared for. And you can care for it in multiple ways, through getting a good night's sleep, keeping it active by listening to intellectually stimulating things like the Tom Woods Show, but there's also BetterHelp online therapy. A lot of times an option like BetterHelp doesn't occur to you because you've just grown accustomed to depression or whatever's holding you back from happiness to the point where you no longer even think of it as something that's fixable. It's just an unavoidable feature of life for you. So my voice speaking to you right now is the pattern interrupt that tells you, wait a minute, you can break out of this. And BetterHelp is a great, convenient way to do so. And I am not ashamed to tell you that I, years ago, used BetterHelp, and it was tremendously beneficial to me. It's online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat-only therapy sessions. So if you don't want to see anybody on camera, you don't have to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/woods. That's betterhelp.com/woods. Then, Graham says, another way to figure out what we might be getting wrong today, because that's the way he's looking at all these things that we're not allowed to say, is that the thinking according to which we are not allowed to say these things may be wrong. And so we're all just making mistakes or being bullied into conformity with prevailing mistakes by not saying them. So he's saying that just as in the past, people censored themselves wrongly and stopped themselves from saying what was true and openly repeated statements that were false, this could be happening today. And I'm trying to identify exactly where it's happening. So another way to figure this out, what we're getting wrong today, is to look at what used to be acceptable and is now unthinkable. So he says, it's true that changes between the past and the present sometimes do represent progress. So in a field like physics, if we disagree with past generations, it's because we're right and they're wrong. But this becomes rapidly less true as you move away from the certainty of the hard sciences. So here's another source of interesting heresies, says Graham. So let's pit present ideas against those of various past cultures and see what you get. Some will be shocking by our standards. Okay, fine, he says, but which might also be true? He says, any idea that's considered harmless in a significant percentage of times and places and yet is taboo in ours is a candidate for something we're mistaken about. And he gives as a trivial example, in the early 1990s, Harvard distributed to its faculty and staff a brochure that said that it was inappropriate to compliment the clothing of a colleague or a student. So no more nice shirt. So Graham says that this principle is probably rare among the world's cultures, past or present. There are probably more where it's considered especially polite to compliment someone's clothing than where it's considered improper. So odds are this is, in a mild form, an example of one of the taboos that a visitor from the future would have to be careful to avoid. Then he says, let's consider what's going on in the head of a child. He says, kids' heads are repositories of all our taboos, because it seems fitting to us that kids' ideas should be bright and clean. So the picture we give them of the world is not merely simplified to suit their developing minds, but sanitized as well, to suit our ideas of what kids ought to think. And he says, now you see this on a small scale when it comes to dirty words. You know, parents are telling their kids, don't say the F word and don't say this word, that word, even though adults use these words all the time. So to an extent, we're giving children a misleading picture of what language is like. Now, why do we do this? Because we don't think it's fitting that kids should use the whole language. We like children to seem innocent, or we tell them about Santa Claus, something like that. So it's probably inevitable that parents are going to want to do this kind of thing. But the important thing for our investigation right now is that as a result of this, a well-brought-up teenage kid's brain is more or less a complete collection of all our taboos and in mint condition because they're untainted by experience. And I love this sentence. Whatever we think that will later turn out to be ridiculous, it's almost certainly inside that head. And so he wants to know, how do we get at these ideas? He says, with the following thought experiment. Imagine a kind of latter-day Conrad character who has worked for a time as a mercenary in Africa, for a time as a doctor in Nepal, for a time as the manager of a nightclub in Miami. The specifics don't matter. Just someone who has seen a lot. And then he says, now compare this to, you know, some teenager living in the suburbs. What among his thoughts would shock that person? Well, he knows the world. The teenager knows or at least embodies present taboos. Subtract one from the other, and the result is what we can't say. And then he says, I can think of one more way to figure out what we can't say. Let's look at how taboos are created. And he hypothesizes that to launch a taboo, a group has to be poised halfway between weakness and power. A confident group doesn't need taboos to protect it. It's not considered improper to make disparaging remarks about Americans or the English, for example. And he says that he suspects that it'll turn out the biggest source of moral taboos will be power struggles in which one side only barely has the upper hand. That's where you'll find a group powerful enough to enforce taboos, but weak enough to need them. And then he says, now, when you look at fashion in general, obviously that's quite different from moral fashion, and that it arises from different sources. But he says the mechanism of their adoption seems much the same. So the early adopters will be driven by ambition. So you have self-consciously cool people who want to distinguish themselves from the common herd, whether it's in their fashion or in, indeed, their moral fashion. But as the fashion becomes established, then they're going to be joined by a second, much larger group driven by fear. This second group adopt the fashion not because they want to stand out, but because they're afraid of standing out. So he says, so if you want to figure out what we can't say, look at the machinery of fashion and try to predict what it would make unsayable. What groups are powerful but nervous? And what ideas would they like to suppress? What ideas were tarnished by association when they ended up on the losing side of a recent struggle? If a self-consciously cool person wanted to differentiate himself from preceding fashions, e.g. from his parents, which of their ideas would he tend to reject? What are conventional-minded people afraid of saying? Now, he says, again, this technique alone won't find for us all the things we can't say, but you combine it with the preceding ones, and you'll turn up a pretty good number of unthinkable ideas. Now, why would anybody want to do this? Why would anybody want to go looking for these forbidden ideas? He says, well, I do it for the same reason I looked under rocks as a kid, plain curiosity. I'm especially curious about anything that's forbidden. Let me see and decide for myself. Second, he says, I don't like the idea of being wrong. If, like other eras of history, we believe things that will later seem ridiculous, I want to know what they are, so I at least can avoid believing them. And then third, he says, I do it because it's good for the brain. To do good work, you need a brain that can go anywhere. And you need a brain that's in the habit of going where it's not supposed to. It's like stretching. When you stretch before running, you put your body into positions much more extreme than any it's going to take during the run. So if you can think things so outside the box, they'd make people's hair stand on end, you'll have no trouble with the small trips outside the box that people call innovative. Well, then we get to his conclusion. Now that we have figured out ways to find out what it is that we're not supposed to say, and by the way, I personally think it's pretty easy to figure out what you're not supposed to say. I don't even think you need to go through all these exercises, but I think all of this helps us understand this phenomenon. He then gives advice that you might feel is a letdown. He says, when you find something you can't say, what do you do with it? My advice is, don't say it, or at least pick your battles. That's kind of a discouraging conclusion. So he tries to defend himself by saying this. Suppose in the future there's a movement to ban the color yellow. Proposals to paint anything yellow are denounced as yellowist, as is anyone suspected of liking the color. People who like orange are tolerated but viewed with suspicion. Now, suppose you realize there's nothing wrong with yellow. If you go around saying this, you'll be denounced as a yellowist too, and you'll find yourself having a lot of arguments with anti-yellowists. If your aim in life is to rehabilitate the color yellow, that may be what you want. But if you're mostly interested in other questions, being labeled as a yellowist will be just a distraction. Argue with idiots and you become an idiot. The most important thing, he says, is to be able to think what you want, not to say what you want. If you feel you have to say everything you think, it may inhibit you from thinking improper thoughts. I think it's better to follow the opposite policy. Draw a sharp line between your thoughts and your speech. Inside your head, anything is allowed. Within my head, I can make a point of encouraging the most outrageous thoughts I can imagine. But as in a secret society, nothing that happens within the building should be told to outsiders. He says, every era has its heresies, and if you don't get imprisoned for them, you will at least get in enough trouble that it becomes a complete distraction. And then he says, I admit it seems cowardly to keep quiet. The problem is, there are so many things you can't say. If you said them all, you'd have no time left for your real work. The trouble, he concludes, with keeping your thoughts secret, though, is that you lose the advantages of discussion. Talking about an idea leads to more ideas. So the optimal plan, if you can manage it, is to have a few trusted friends you can speak openly to. This is not just a way to develop ideas. It's also a good rule of thumb for choosing friends. The people you can say heretical things to without getting jumped on are also the most interesting to know. Now, whether you accept that advice, of course, is entirely up to you. But I couldn't share the article with you without saying that that is his rather unimpressive conclusion. Now, you can understand for practical reasons, you don't want to get fired, you know, whatever it is, that maybe there are some things that you'd rather not say in public. But we need people saying them, it seems to me, because otherwise we let stupid, crazy people impose falsehoods on everybody and ruin their lives for not accepting them. And the more people push back, the more it encourages other people who say, ah, I'm not the only one who realizes this is a ridiculous thing to say and that I should be able to say the opposite. He does offer some advice for how to dissent publicly from these things. And it's not super robust, but it's not nothing. So what he recommends is, he says, perhaps the best policy is to make it plain that you don't agree with whatever zealotry is current in your time, but not to be too specific about what you disagree with. So he says, better still, answer, I haven't decided. He says, that's what Larry Summers did. You remember Larry Summers got in trouble when he made comments about men and women and how they learn and stuff. He said, well, look, I don't do litmus tests. And that's where he just left it. I mean, I don't know about that. Larry Summers was an influential enough guy. You would think he could just say, look, there's plenty of science behind what I said. And what I said is what everybody secretly believes and knows. So what's the problem with saying it? But he just decided he didn't want to be a martyr for that. Another thing that you can do is ratchet the debate up a level of abstraction. So he says, for example, the term political correctness was great because it meant the beginning of the end of political correctness, because it enabled you to attack the phenomenon as a whole without being accused of any of the specific heresies that it sought to suppress. He says, another way to counterattack would be with metaphor, the way Arthur Miller did in The Crucible, attacking the House Un-American Activities Committee by comparing it to the Salem witch trials. Well, you know, Arthur Miller was actually pro-communist, so not the best example, but it is an example, nevertheless, of the use of metaphor. And then finally, Graham says, if a statement is false, that's the worst thing you can say about it. You don't need to say that it's heretical. And if it isn't false, it shouldn't be suppressed. So when you see statements being attacked as X-ist or Y-ick, and he says, substitute your current values of X and Y, whether it's 1630 or 2030, that's a sure sign that something is wrong. When you hear such labels being used, ask why. All right, again, I'm going to link to this article at tomwoods.com/2166 if you'd like to read the whole thing. You can also go to paulgraham.com/say, and you'll find the article there. Make sure you do not skip over tomorrow's episode with the great Henry Bingaman. I just met him this year, and he impresses the heck out of me, so much so that I hired him to do some work for me. And let's just say I'm a little picky when it comes to that. But he's a really, really brilliant guy, very, very engaging, and I think he should be better known within our circles. So tomorrow's your opportunity to get to know him, episode 2167. So thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.